Good evening. Trump vows to fight. Rudy in Pennsylvania stirs the pot. Midnight regulations, the death of a soccer idol, and hunger on Thanksgiving. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. President Trump tweeted he's granted a full pardon to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn today. Congratulations to General Flynn and his wonderful family. I know you will now have a truly fantastic Thanksgiving, Trump tweeted. Flynn resigned shortly after being appointed to the job in early 2017 when the FBI discovered he had lied to Vice President Mike Pence about his contacts with Russian government officials, purportedly in search of dirt to use against then-candidate Hillary Clinton. Flynn pleaded guilty, but later disavowed his plea and tried to get the case thrown out. It's another case of Trump using his pardon powers for personal, political, and showmanship reasons. Among Trump's pardons, people like Joe Arpaio, a former Arizona sheriff convicted of lying about racial profiling, Dinesh D'Souza, right-wing commentator convicted of violating campaign finance laws, and Michael Milken, a financier convicted of securities fraud. And Vice President-elect Kamala Harris says she hasn't spoken to current Vice President Mike Pence yet.
Have you spoken with Vice President Pence?
Thank you, Paul.
Not yet.
But you were. Thank you.
Harris was standing alongside husband Doug Emhoff as the pair made a surprise stop by D.C. Central Kitchen to thank CEO Mike Curtin, chef and philanthropist Jose Andres, and the rest of their staff for their work combating hunger. We'll be returning to the issue of hunger later on in the cast. President-elect Joe Biden delivered his Thanksgiving address from Wilmington, Delaware. Biden called for unity as the country enters the holiday and continues to battle the pandemic. He says COVID will be his top job when he assumes office on January 20th.
Starting on day one of my presidency, we will take steps that will change the course of this disease. More testing will find people with cases and get them away from one another, slowing the number of infections. More protective gear for businesses and our schools to do the same, reducing the number of cases. Clear guidance will get more businesses and more schools open. We all have a role to play in beating this crisis. The federal government has vast powers to combat the virus. And I commit to you, I will use all of those powers to lead a national coordinated response. But the federal government can't do this alone. Each of us has a responsibility in our own lives to do what we can do to slow the virus. Every decision we make matters. Every decision we make can save lives. None of these steps we're asking people to take are political statements. Every one of them is based on science, real science. Now, the good news is there has been significant record-breaking progress made recently in developing a vaccine. And several of these vaccines look extraordinarily effective. And it happens that we're on track for the first immunization to begin by late December, early January. Then we'll need to put in place a distribution plan to get the entire country immunized as soon as possible, which we will do, but it's going to take time.
According to Johns Hopkins University, the United States reported 2,146 deaths from COVID-19 on Tuesday, only the second time since early May the country topped 2,000 reported deaths in a single day. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended last week Americans not travel for Thanksgiving, although millions took to the skies and the highways, disregarding increasingly dire warnings. Biden went on to assert his victory, saying the election, where he prevailed by 6 million votes, was something to be thankful for.
What should we give thanks for this season? Well, first, let's be thankful for democracy itself. In this last election, the one that just took place, we've seen record numbers of Americans exercise the most sacred right, that of the vote, to register their will at the ballot box. Think about that. In the middle of a pandemic, more people voted this year than have ever voted in the history of the United States of America. Over 150 million people cast a ballot. Simply extraordinary. Many waiting in line 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to vote. you want to know what beats deep in the heart of America, it's this: democracy. The right to determine our lives, our government, and our leaders. The right to be heard. Our democracy was tested this year. And what we learned is this: the people of this nation are up to the task. In America, we have full and fair and free elections. And then we honor the results. The people of this nation and the laws of the land won't stand for anything else. Through the vote, the noblest instrument of nonviolent protest ever conceived, we remained anew and were reminded anew that progress is possible, that we the people, have the power to change what Jefferson called the course of human events.
President-elect Joe Biden. Meanwhile, President Trump claimed anew that he had won the election, calling into an event held by Pennsylvania Republicans to investigate unproven allegations of voter fraud.
I saw, with my eyes what happened, and he told me horror stories, absolute horror stories. So this was very sad to say it. This election was rigged, and we can't let that happen. We can't let it happen for our country, and this election has to be turned around.
Pennsylvania Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar made the final count official 3 weeks after the November 3rd election. That was yesterday. Biden received 3,458,229 votes, 80,554 more than President Donald Trump's 3,377,674 votes. Biden won 50.01% of the vote, the 48.8% for Trump. The GOP event in Pennsylvania was called to hear Trump's lawyer, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, present what he says are witnesses to fraud in the presidential election. The witnesses were unsworn. President Trump took a moment to praise Rudy as New York's greatest mayor.
Thank Rudy Giuliani for having the courage to do this. There are other lawyers that backed down because they were being screamed at. Rudy is the greatest mayor in the history of New York, and there's a reason. He's got great courage, and he doesn't care. He wants to do what's right. And I told him the other day, Rudy, you were the greatest mayor in the history of New York, and you see what happened to New York without Rudy. You were the greatest mayor, but this is more important. What you're doing now is far more important than being a great mayor of the city of New York and being its greatest mayor by far. By the way, by far. This is going to be your crowning achievement because you're saving our country. Thank you all very much.
And the people who are supporting Trump, led by Rudy Giuliani, have filed over 30 cases contesting different aspects of the election in states Trump lost to Biden. So far, they've won one, a minor case that had very little effect on the vote count. Attorneys have been repeatedly dressed down by judges for showing up without evidence or for claiming fraud in press conferences, but then not daring to make those false claims in court where it can get an attorney in a lot of trouble. In the most important of the cases, a Pennsylvania lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice by a federal judge who is a conservative Republican. The judge said the suit demanded that he disenfranchise almost 7 million voters, but provided no evidence of corruption and was based on a strained legal argument without merit and speculative accusations. Reputable law firms like Porter Wright that have enabled and collaborated with Trump over the years are now backing away, leaving only the conspiracy theory ravings of people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell to pursue his program in court. Giuliani's witnesses, almost all associated with the right-wing anti-abortion Thomas More Society, presented no evidence, just conjecture. Giuliani echoed the charge that America's cities are just naturally corrupt.
And I guess the crooks in Philadelphia are disappointed in this. They only submitted 8,021 ballots from dead people, mail-in ballots for dead people. Probably easier for dead people to submit mail-in ballots than it is to vote in person. You had about 30,000 of those. We're checking the records of the cemeteries around Philadelphia.
Giuliani then made a plea to Pennsylvania's Republican-dominated legislature to take the already certified election away from Biden.
The election for the President of the United States is not run by the governor of your state. It's not run by your election commissioner. The United States Constitution makes it clear who has the responsibility for running this election. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 of our Constitution doesn't say that ABC gets to call the winner or CNN. It says... Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. It's the state legislature that controls this process. It's your power. It's your responsibility. And because if this happens without consequence, if they can just enter 600,000 some odd mail-in ballots without allowing a single Republican to view it, what's to say that next time they won't do a million or 2 million? I know crooks really well. You give them an inch and they take a mile, and you give them a mile and they take your whole country.
Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, the hotel where the Republicans met is about a mile from the scene of Pickett's charge, where Union troops repelled a desperate Confederate attack in July 1863. It helped turn the tide of the American Civil War against the slave-owning South. And even as the Trump presidency is becoming more akin to the lost cause of the Confederacy, his White House and executive agencies are racing to finalize his policy priorities before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. It's common for outgoing administrations to rush through last-minute rules, but these midnight regulations can shortchange public input. ProPublica has been tracking some of the controversial regulations advancing through the federal government in its final days. The lead reporter is Isaac Arnsdorf.
When the White House is changing hands, the outgoing administration uses this window as a chance to tie the successor's hands, and that's certainly what appears to be going on here. What we're trying to do is keep tabs on all the controversial and consequential rules that either have advanced after Election Day or are kind of teed up to be finalized between Election Day and the inauguration. It's 12 that have already been finalized, but we've got another couple dozen that are in the pipeline and could. It looks like the administration is trying to get over the finish line before Biden takes over.
What prevents the new president from just reversing all of these?
The legal process of a federal agency creating a regulation is pretty arduous, and that's by design, because you don't want federal agencies to just be able to basically do whatever they want on a whim. So they have to go through this long process of publishing a draft and soliciting public input and addressing all those comments and then publishing a final version, so and building a record that ultimately can withstand a court challenge. And that's something that typically takes a number of years. It's not necessarily that a future administration couldn't undo it, but it might take a really long time to go through that process again, start back at square one, and build a case for why the policy should change. Now, some of the other possibilities are it could get challenged in court and struck down. And the Trump administration, frankly, has a pretty bad record of winning cases like that.
They're not going to be the Trump administration.
The next administration might choose not to defend those policies or appeal decisions to strike them down. And then the other possibility is Congress. There's a mechanism called the Congressional Review Act, which is like a fast-track mechanism for a simple majority in both houses to repeal a recent regulation. And Republicans used this more than a dozen times in 2017 to undo midnight regulations from the Obama administration. The Biden administration is going to probably depend on what happens in the Georgia runoffs.
Looking at one here, allowing federal death row inmates to be executed by means other than lethal injection.
And this popped up over the summer and kind of escaped notice. The Justice Department has resumed federal executions this year for the first time since 2003 and has scheduled a whole bunch of them to try to execute these people before Biden takes office. It's difficult to get the drugs that are considered acceptable by courts for lethal injection. This policy change tries to give the government more flexibility by allowing other methods that might be legal in various states, such as firing squads and the electric chair.
There's two groups here, one about drug prices. Some of them seem like they would be positive. They're like annoying drug companies. He wants to have cheaper drug prices. What's wrong with that?
This is something that the administration has been kind of on again, off again about, and finally did last week. The reason that the White House backed off from it previously was a concern that it was going to end up leading to higher Medicare premiums. That's one thing that people are watching to see what the effect of that ends up being. Obviously, lower prescription drug prices would be good for consumers, but if that ends up leading to shifting the cost to premiums, then they end up paying for it a different way.
Several rules relating to allowing truckers to drive on the highways with less sleep or less time between sleep, and allowing people under 21 to be long-haul truckers.
Those are both examples of pretty clearly business interests, the administration trying to accommodate them through loosening safety and labor protection rules, which has certainly been a theme throughout the years of the Trump administration and is just kind of now happening on an accelerated timeline. I think it's interesting to point out, though, they're not all examples of just kind of bending over backwards to an industry interest. There are a few interesting cases where the administration is actually bucking the business-friendly position. Some examples of that are reducing H-1B visas for high-skilled workers, which are very important to the technology industry. And there's another interesting example of creating or loosening efficiency regulations for clothes washing machines. And actually, the manufacturers are opposed to that because they basically think it's unnecessary. They already offer consumers the options that they want. It's interesting to see cases where there are ideological commitments from administration officials, either in terms of reducing immigration or just reducing regulation and trying to shrink the footprint of government, that don't necessarily line up with what big business wants.
Trump and his compatriots are building a movement for the future.
They're trying to formalize things that they've done through practice throughout the administration, and certainly in the immigration area. This is an example where these are a lot of policies that they've already been doing, but by formalizing them as a rule, it makes it harder for the Biden administration to just flip the switch on them.
Reporter Isaac Arnsdorf. In a surprise move for the development-friendly Trump administration, it effectively killed a proposed gold and copper mine in Alaska, envisioned as deep as the Grand Canyon and filling an NFL stadium with nearly 3,900 times over with waste, all near the headwaters of the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. The Army Corps of Engineers concluded that the proposed project is contrary to the public interest and denied a permit to build the Pebble Mine under both the Clean Water Act and the Rivers and Harbors Act. It's at odds with Trump's efforts to open up part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling and other moves to roll back environmental protections benefiting oil and gas industries. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. With more than 2 million New York City residents, one in four people, currently struggling with food insecurity, Hunger Free America analyzed SNAP, formerly called food stamps, data to determine the increase in federal benefits recipients during the pandemic. With an unemployment rate of 13.2%, hunger is stalking New York and affecting middle-class families as well as the poor. The Bronx, which had an unemployment rate of nearly 19% at the end of September, compared to 4.8% a year ago. At the virtual news conference, top chef and activist Tom Colicchio had this to say.
Yeah, tomorrow's Thanksgiving, and we're going to see news stories again tomorrow. We're going to see the turkeys given out, and that's great that so many people are doing this work. It's really important to feed our fellow Americans, and everyone's going to pitch in. That's great, but let's keep in mind after that turkey that they get after standing in line for an hour or two, they're going to be hungry the next day, and they're going to be hungry the next day. And it's only smart policies that can fix this. Smart government policies from governments that want to think big, and do well for their constituents. It's the season of hope right now, and I have hope. And this is why I have hope. Because these lines that we're seeing, 3 hours long, of people waiting to get food, these are from people who 8 months ago were solidly middle class. They're in their cars. I'm seeing Mercedes and BMWs in those lines. These are people who never thought in a million years that they would struggle, that they would have to try to figure out where they're going to feed their family. And so I'm hoping that when we get through this pandemic, that as a country, we're going to have more empathy for people who are struggling. No one asked to get born into poverty. And yet we keep hearing the stories about just kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and maybe you've made mistakes and go get a job and don't have as many children. All we hear this and we know what these, it's a bullhorn. We know what they're saying. And so I'm hoping that those people who bought into that narrative, that they're going to look at themselves and say, now I get it. It's a bad break. This is why I'm here. And so we'll have a greater sense of empathy. And I'm hoping with our new administration under President-elect Biden, he has that empathy. And hopefully that will encourage more people to think this way. Because we can end hunger. This isn't something that's far off that we can't sort of grasp. There are a lot of big problems out there that are going to be problems for a long time. But ending hunger in our country is something we all can do. And again, smart, effective, good government will do that.
Tom Colicchio is a food activist and famous chef. New York Senator Kristen Gillibrand was asked by WBAI if the change in the White House meant a respite for the hungry in America.
There's a couple of things the new administration can do right away. We have to make it easier for people to get access to SNAP benefits. I have a bill called Closing the Meal Gap, with which Senator, now Vice President-elect Harris, will support it in the Senate. That would increase the maximum and minimum benefits, and it would expand eligibility. They might be able to even do some of that just through regulation. I've also advocated to increase access to online purchases using SNAP benefits, which, again, they could probably do that through regulation. And if not, then just voicing support for it would make it easier for me to pass that in the Senate. We need to expand access for students. There's a lot of students that are going hungry, and making sure places like Puerto Rico can transition to the SNAP program too. So these are all things that the White House can try to do unilaterally, but if not, they can raise their support for it, which at least can get me all Democrats, and then I can find a few Republicans that will cross over. And I do work with many Republicans like Lisa Murkowski on SNAP benefits and food programs. So I am optimistic.
New York Senator Kristen Gillibrand. The CEO of Hunger Free America is Joel Berg. He says the problem is low pay and no jobs.
We released two reports on hunger today. One was hunger in New York City, and that showed a 65% increase in the number of people going to pantries and kitchens, but that amount was really dwarfed by the massive increase in SNAP benefits, what used to be called food stamps. And then we released a national report, a poll of over 800 low-income people nationwide to find out what they thought were the solutions were to the problem. And they basically said more living wage jobs, affordable health care and housing, and to ensure that we have an adequate nutrition safety net.
Was this predictable?
Our findings today were utterly predictable. We said in 2018, look, we have this massive structural hunger problem when the economy was still theoretically in great shape. In New York City, 1 million people were food insecure in 2018, and 8 million Americans nationwide. And so it's utterly predictable that when you have a massive recession, if there are so many hungry people to begin with, you're going to have a mass hunger crisis.
What are you hoping is going to happen as far as the White House?
We are hopeful that the new Biden-Harris team will seriously address these issues. I note that Vice President-elect Harris went to D.C. Central Kitchen today and highlighted the importance of doing something about hunger. There's a lot of proposals on their desk that they can really take action on day one to get people more food using the safety net better. So we are cautiously optimistic, although it's our job as advocates to work with them to get the job done.
How is it that there's hunger in a country as wealthy as America?
Bottom line is tens of millions of Americans and now 2 million New Yorkers just don't earn enough money to feed their families. If you're paying $24,000 a year for rent, and that's not a lot for a New Yorker, $2,000 a month is not uncommon even in a low-income neighborhood for a one- or two-bedroom apartment, and you're making, you know, $30,000 a year, we shouldn't be shocked that people are hungry when they have $6,000 left over after paying for rent to pay for utilities, transportation, child care, health care, and, yes, food.
What can people do, average people who are listening to this?
Average people can call and write their elected officials, telling them to get on the stick to do more. They can donate to groups like Hunger Free America that really deal with the root causes of the problem and engage in advocacy. And when they do volunteer, they can go to hungervolunteer.org and find more effective ways to use their professional skills to volunteer. But the most important thing people should do is contact their elected officials, telling them they want government action now.
Joel Berg is CEO of Hunger Free America. And finally, Diego Maradona, the Argentine who became a national hero, is one of soccer's greatest players, performing with a roguish cunning and extravagant control while pursuing a personal life rife with drug and alcohol abuse and health problems, died on Wednesday in Tigre, Argentina, in Buenos Aires province. He was 60. His spokesperson, Sebastian Sanchi, said the cause was a heart attack. Maradona had undergone brain surgery several weeks ago. News of the death brought an outpouring of mourning and remembrance in Argentina, becoming virtually the sole topic of conversation. Such was his stature. In 2000, FIFA, soccer's governing body, voted him and Pelé of Brazil the sport's two greatest players, and the government declared 3 days of national mourning. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening, and have a loving and safe Thanksgiving.